Chapter 5, Continued.
Now, where were we? It's not hard to imagine Hopkins, on that December day in 1944, gunning for Kravchenko, grim. The four-poster bed in the Lincoln bedroom, littered with papers. The dramatic, floor-to-almost-ceiling windows overlooking the winter-parched South Lawn. The historic desk on which Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. Was it Hopkins himself, sitting at that same hallowed desk, who picked up the phone to put the heat on Kravchenko? If so, it's also not hard to imagine the hapless Secretary of State Stettinius on the other end of the line, he who was unforgettably described by an aide at one time as not having a desk in his office, just a table and telephone because, Stettinius said, deadpan, the papers should be with the man who is doing the job. Were Davies and Hopkins together doing the job, if or when it was Hopkins who phoned Stettinius? Or maybe Davies had already left Hopkins, returning to Tregaron, his Rock Creek Park mansion, now an outbuilding of the Washington International School, where perhaps he sat in his library to write in his journal. Did a dark-eyed Romanov portrait, souvenir of his Moscow posting, I Stalin's leading public apologist as he wrote up the events of the day? More likely, it was the silver-framed and autographed photo of Stalin himself that oversaw Davies at work, a last-minute gift at the train station, along with a plea from Litvinov, he who toasted Davies as Moscow's envoy in America, for unbiased judgments on Soviet life in anything Davies might ever write. Not to worry, as mission to Moscow would prove. Davies would prominently display his framed Stalin in the library for years to come. Yes, it was probably Stalin's gaze on Davies as he duly recorded Hopkins' outrage over Kravchenko's desertion. Hopkins' job with the president was to represent the Russian interests. My job was to represent the American interests. So disconcertingly stated George C. Marshall, Army Chief of Staff, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Defense, to Forrest Pogue, his official biographer, on January 22, 1957. That's a statement to shock anyone. Hopkins and Marshall were the two top wartime advisors to FDR. They may have had differences, but what Marshall describes isn't normal. Harry's job was to represent the Russian interests. Marshall's job, the American interests. And the president would choose between the two? I can just see the Norman Rockwell illustration of this triumvirate dominated by a quizzical FDR, the American representative Marshall, at one ear, the Soviet representative Hopkins at the other. American interest versus Soviet interest. Whatever did Marshall mean by that? And whose interests, American or Soviet, did he think won the day? Should it concern us that Marshall was yet another Hopkins protege? Hopkins biographer McJimsey tells us Marshall always believed that Hopkins had been responsible for his appointment as chief of staff. Unfortunately, Pogue wasn't able, didn't want to, or couldn't imagine his way to seize the moment and find out the answers to such questions, which harken back, sub rosa, to George Racy Jordan's 1949-1950 Lend-Lease testimony before Congress. In addition to testimony on black suitcases, atomic materials, and the continuous Soviet-American diplomatique runaround, Jordan, a 14-carat witness as established above, had leveled two sensational charges about Harry Hopkins. The first pertained to a note on White House stationery signed with the initials H.H., maybe not an exact transcription Jordan would later write, but close, which Jordan took to denote Harry Hopkins. Jordan said he found the note inside one of the black suitcases he searched on that winter night when he raced back to the airfield. Given Hopkins' role as Lendlease chief, there was nothing odd about a note from Hopkins in a shipment of Lendlease supplies. Indeed, from day one of Jordan's mission as a Lendlease expediter, he said, Harry Hopkins' name was invoked daily by the Russians, as many others attested. Similarly, there was nothing odd about the second charge Jordan brought to the committee regarding a telephone conversation Jordan said he had had with Hopkins. It was about expediting a certain shipment through Great Falls. Nothing necessarily eyebrow-raising about that, either. Jordan was the lead expediter, after all. What was odd, what was more than passing strange, was the content of both the note and the phone call. According to Jordan, both the note and the phone call concerned atomic-related shipments to Moscow. The HH note was affixed to two documents. One was a thick map, as wide as the span of my extended arm, Jordan wrote, with a legend he recorded as Oak Ridge, Manhattan Engineering District, which, completely unbeknownst to Jordan at the time, was the top-secret headquarters of the U.S. Atomic Project. The other was a carbon copy of a report, presumably for Harry Hopkins. His name was stamped or typed on the front, Jordan said, which was filled with those outlandish words, cyclotron and deuteron, and curious phrases, energy produced by fission, and walls 5 feet thick, mentioned above. This was where Jordan met the word uranium for the first time. Then came the Hopkins phone call. One day in April 1943, a most critical month in the history of American betrayal, as we shall see, Jordan said his Soviet colleague, Colonel Khodakov, handed him the receiver. On the phone was Harry Hopkins. This, Jordan told Congress, was the first and only contact Jordan had with the Lend-Lease head in 24 months of service. "Big boss, Mr. Hopkins wants you," Khodakov said. Jordan had no reason to believe it was anyone other than Hopkins on the line, as some would later suggest, particularly after Hopkins inquired whether Jordan had received a windfall supply of scarce pilots to break up a logjam of 200 anti-tank air cobras destined for bases in the USSR that had piled up at the airfield. Only Hopkins, Jordan believed, could have known about this snafu. Hopkins went on to tell Jordan about a certain shipment of chemicals that would be coming through Great Falls and would need expediting. "Okay, boss? But I don't want you to discuss it with anyone," Hopkins said. "And it is not to go on the records. Don't make a big production of it, but just send it through quietly, in a hurry." "Yes, sir," was the essence of Jordan's reply. After all, Hopkins, as Jordan wrote, was a legendary figure of the day, the top man in the world of Lend-Lease in which I lived. Jordan later quizzed Khodakov as to what these chemicals might be and where they'd be coming from. Khodakov pulled out a folder called Bomb Powder. "Presumably, after the talk with Hopkins, I had been accepted as a member of the Lodge, as an aside," Jordan dryly commented. "I show you," Khodakov announced. He drew out a paper sheet and set a finger against one entry. "For a second time, my eyes encountered the word uranium." This uranium would come to Great Falls, Montana, from a mine in Canada. If you know anything about U.S. uranium stocks during the war, not a burning topic of contemporary interest, I know, that last line about Canada is a clincher, a denouement-style revelation that could well be punctuated with an ominous, wavering organ chord. Let me explain. This uranium shipment, news of which Jordan first brought to the public in December 1949, following that first successful and shocking Soviet atomic test, was confirmed to have been pushed through to the USSR by federal agencies led by Lend-Lease. In fact, a thorough document search yielded a paper trail of freight bills and other items definitively tracking the uranium's progress. This shipment, which Hopkins apparently tipped off Jordan to, was the second of three shipments totaling nearly 0.75 tons. A fourth research-related shipment of heavy water was also later confirmed. What is notable? What is Oregoncourt ominous about the Hopkin tie-in here is its timing. At the very point Hopkins was on the phone with Jordan in April 1943, the Manhattan Project, under General Leslie Groves, had already placed an embargo on the export of uranium chemicals from the United States. Groves did so after the first Soviet shipment of uranium chemicals had passed through Great Falls without drawing Jordan's attention in March 1943. It wasn't until after the war ended that the general even learned from House investigators that the Soviets had thwarted his embargo on uranium exports by tapping Canadian stocks. Sure enough, when the Hopkins-tipped shipment finally arrived in Great Falls in June 1943, it came in under Russian guard from Toronto. Jordan copied down the guard's name, identifying him with the initials CC for Canadian Courier. After Jordan made this story public in December 1949, the Air Force pilot of the plane, Ben L. Brown of Cincinnati, came forward to identify himself, adding not only corroboration, but a colorful stroke to the story. After taking off from Great Falls and unloading in Fairbanks, Alaska, one of the wooden boxes fell from the plane, the pilot said. A corner broke, from which some chocolate brown powder spilled. Out of curiosity, Brown picked up a handful, whereupon a Soviet officer slapped the crystals from his hand, explaining, "No, no! Burn hands." Nice vivid detail, but it doesn't detract from the glaring import of Jordan's story. He wrote in his 1952 memoir, "My share in this revelation was testimony under oath, leading to one conclusion, that the Canadian bypass was aided by Mr. Hopkins. At his direction, Lend-Lease issued a certificate of release, without which the consignment could not have moved. Lend-Lease channels of transportation and Lend-Lease personnel, such as myself, were used. Traces of the scheme were kept off the books by making it a cash transaction." A kingdom for Marshall's biographer to have asked, "What do you know about Harry Hopkins' role in helping the Soviets obtain vital materials and scientific data related to our atomic program? Were you aware of it at the time? Was the president aware of it? Why do you think Harry Hopkins would illegally conspire to thwart the embargo designed to protect America's most precious war secret?" Instead, Polk's question to Marshall was, "During the congressional hearings in the late 1940s, early 1950s, one or two witnesses indicated that the Army's efforts to prevent critical material from going to the Russians was overridden by Mr. Hopkins. Any comment on this?" Marshall's reply, "I don't remember just what the reaction was in hearings in relation to giving items to Russia." Sounds as if the old Washington hound was buying a little time to think. Because, of course, he hadn't been asked to recall the reaction in hearings or elsewhere to such testimony, but rather for his own comments. He added, "Hopkins' job with the president was to represent the Russian interests. My job was to represent the American interests. And I was opposed to any, what I call, undue generosity, which might endanger our security. I thought we gave too much at times, and Hopkins thought we gave too little, which would always be the case. Sounds like a yes, Hopkins overrode the embargo, but Pogue didn't push it. Instead, he asked, do you feel the administration was overgenerous with the Soviet government? Marshall, I have answered that question just now. Well, no, not exactly, General. But the moment passed, even as a multitude of questions formed and hung there. Just to confirm, General, it sounds as if you are obliquely confirming the allegation that Hopkins helped the Soviets procure materials for their nuclear program, including uranium, that General Groves had designated off-limits for export. Correct? And what exactly do you mean by saying Hopkins' job was representing the Russian interests? Are you saying Hopkins in some way worked for the Russians? Had a special dossier from the Russians? Do you think it was in the best interests of the United States that the closest advisor to the president represented the Russian interests? Or that he elevated two men to run Lend-Lease, about whom U.S. Ambassador to Moscow, Admiral William H. Standley, would write, General James Burns is of the same beliefs as General Philip Faymonville. Russian interests come first, last, and all the time. Did you ever wonder about such things? Worry about them? Seek to learn anything more about them. Do something about them. You yourself have said you owed your elevation to military chief to Harry Hopkins. Looking back, do you think this sense of gratitude adversely affected any of your actions? Of course, not even the surface of this subject was disturbed, and the whole matter sank to the bottom and went dormant. I do mean dormant. Dead. More than 30 years passed, 44 years since the ever-ailing Hopkins finally died in 1946, before a trusted KGB defector, Oleg Gordievsky, a former KGB colonel and KGB London chief, who later served as an undercover British secret agent in Moscow between 1974 and 1985. Really churned things up. In 1990, Gordievsky reported that as a young KGB agent in the 1960s, he had heard Ishak Akhmerov, the most spectacular of the secret Soviet spy masters, or illegals, in wartime America, devote most of a lecture at KGB headquarters to the man whom, he alleged, was the most important of all Soviet wartime agents in the United States, Harry Hopkins. Not only was Akhmerov responsible for the oversight of spies including Lachlan Curry, Nathan Gregory Silvermaster, Elizabeth Bentley, and Harry Dexter White, calling Harry Hopkins a Soviet agent, he was calling him the most important agent of all, more important than the far more infamous Alger Hiss or the Rosenbergs, more important even than ultra-damaging White, whom Haynes, Clare, and Vasiliev label the most highly placed asset the Soviets possessed in the American government. White's Soviet-directed input, Operation Snow, helped, first, to provoke the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and, later, through the Morgenthau Plan, to prolong German resistance to the bitter end. Germany's utter destruction, an important Soviet goal, came about as a result. No less than Elizabeth Bentley testified to White's role to push the devastation of Germany through the Morgenthau Plan because that was what the Russians wanted. How could anyone be more important than that? Hopkins was, though, said Akhmerov. Gordievsky went on to discuss this revelation with a number of officers in Soviet intelligence, and all believed that Hopkins had been an agent of major significance. Akhmerov, Gordievsky said, also spoke of his occasional meetings with Hopkins, which, he said, preceded Hopkins' historic first visit to the USSR in July 1941. When exactly did they take place? We don't know. As a temporal point of reference, Hopkins, practically the original New Dealer, was, by May 1933, already ensconced in the first Roosevelt administration as the head of federal unemployment relief, supposedly his own and a colleague's idea. "Money flies," said the Washington Post headline, under a front-page photo of Hopkins as Hopkins gave away $5 million Depression dollars in his first 2 hours on the job. More significant, by the fall of 1933, Hopkins biographer McJimsey tells us Hopkins was participating in a communist-organized study group at the Department of Agriculture. Not that McJimsey describes it that way. This interpretation comes from intelligence experts Romerstein and Brindell. McJimsey put it more antiseptically. Hopkins entered liberal circles in the fall of 1933 when he and Obray Williams began attending informal meetings with a group from the Department of Agriculture, including Paul Appleby, whom Hopkins had known at Grinnell College, Gardner Jackson, Lee Pressman, Jerome Frank, and Rex Tugwell. We're left to our own devices to evaluate Hopkins' ag mates who, in McJimsey's telling, were brought together by a shared interest in projects to help the poor. The first time through, my eyes skimmed over the names as though I were searching for something else in the phone book. Didn't register. Later, after reading both Martin Dye's and Robert Stripling's memoirs, I recognized Gardner Jackson as the instigator of an attempt in 1940 to discredit Representative Martin Dye's, chairman of the House Un-American Activities Committee, with a document later unmasked as a forgery. Rexford Tugwell, whose name sounds like someone out of F. Scott Fitzgerald, vaguely resonated. McJimsey notes that Tugwell had the most trenchant ideas, which, extra research revealed, arose from the young Columbia econ professor's swoony, steely admiration of what was still called the Soviet experiment. Such ideas included putting the government in total control of the economy, production controls, price controls, profit controls, the works. In case there's any doubt where Tugwell was coming from, he predicted in 1931, business will be logically required to disappear. The end of the free market, the abolition of business, was one of his hobby horses. "Tugwell sees end of laissez-faire," the New York Times headlined in 1934. That fall, McJimsey writes of 1933, Hopkins tried to persuade Roosevelt to articulate a New Deal philosophy along Tugwell's lines, but the president was reluctant. No wonder. Congressional elections were coming up, and the president didn't want to blow them by going completely Bolshevik. Better, I'm thinking, to preserve a good cop, FDR, bad cop, Tugwell, deniability. When Romerstein and Brindell looked at McJimsey's list, the tip-off for them was the presence of Lee Pressman, who happened, if that's the right word, to be a Harvard Law School classmate of Alger Hiss. In 1948, Whitaker Chambers identified Pressman as a very big communist cheese, one of seven leading members of a communist apparatus within the U.S. government, each of whom was charged with organizing a study group or cell in his respective agency. The way it worked was that members would be further evaluated by communist cell leaders, after which they might be selected to join the communist underground and work in Soviet espionage. Pressman's agency was agriculture. Suddenly, McJimsey's study group looks less revival meeting and more Marxist conspiracy meet and greet. Was Hopkins tapped for advanced work here? We have no evidence. Which isn't to say it didn't happen. My hunch is that if Hopkins were in fact an Akhmerov agent, and as we will see, his contact with Akhmerov is confirmed, he may have belonged to a network we don't know about, or a network of one. This little ag group, by the way, with the exception of Pressman, remains clean when it comes to official espionage links. But they were all fellow travelers active in communist or Soviet causes, which is, after all, what fellow travelers do. Take Jerome Frank, who was Rexford Tugwell's housemate. Frank was a drafter of the New Deal law that ushered in the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, the New Deal agency empowered to compel farmers to limit or destroy their output in exchange for government subsidies. More Bolshevistic than any law or regulation existing in Soviet Russia, said Representative Fred Bitten, Republican of Illinois. We are on our way to Moscow, said Representative Joseph W. Martin, Democrat of Massachusetts. Frank became the AAA's general counsel, an appointment Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., in his book The Coming of the New Deal, called a triumph for the liberals. Liberals. I look at Frank's hires for the counsel's office and see some of the most notorious communists of the day mixed in among the liberals. Or is that vice versa? From Harvard Law School alone, Frank hired Alger Hiss, Lee Pressman, John Apt, and Nathan Witt, all members of the secret communist apparatus known as the Ware Group, later identified by Whitaker Chambers as a hardened espionage unit. Hopkins' little study group appears to be a low-impact offshoot. Maybe not so low-impact. Tugwell, after all, Frank's housemate, was a radical's radical and the foremost member of FDR's so-called brain trust. One of the leaders, William A. Wirt, attempted to bring to Congress's attention in May 1934 for allegedly plotting revolution from within. Arthur Schlesinger relates an anecdote about an overnight visit from a friend of Frank's from his, yes, corporate law days to the Frank Tugwell home. The friend, in Schlesinger's words, became shocked by Tugwell in a mood of early morning intensity. Tugwell probably read him selections from his latest oeuvre, something about how the solution to the central problem of subordinating the profit motive to social welfare lay in genuine economic planning and social control. After departing, the friend cabled Jerome Frank with a warning about Tugwell. Beware, comma, Jerome, stop. This morning at breakfast I saw the face of Robespierre. Such was the red-hot Washington scene Akhmerov found on arriving to take control of the secret intelligence network of the middle 1930s. We don't know exactly when. Until he was recalled to Moscow in late 1939. Having survived Stalin's show trials and purges, he returned to the United States in December 1941. Hopkins, a fixture of the Roosevelt administration since 1933, first traveled to the USSR in July 1941. As Romerstein and Brindell note, this timeline tells us Akhmerov must have worked with Hopkins in the 1930s before Akhmerov returned to the Soviet Union in 1939. While we can't pinpoint the initial date of Akhmerov-Hopkins' contact, there is a crucial significance to the relationship. Illegals, such as Akhmerov, always operate outside official channels, always operate undercover. Think of the 10 illegals bagged and returned to Russia in 2010. In other words, they have none of the protections of the embassy, including diplomatic immunity. On the contrary, using false identities, they pose as ordinary persons simply residing in their host country. Akhmerov, for example, on his return to the United States in December 1941, held a phony U.S. passport, avoided all contact with CPUSA chief Earl Browder, even though he was married to Browder's niece, and, in March 1942, moved to Baltimore to open a fur and clothing business in partnership with a local Soviet agent, from which to run his agents based in Washington. As Romerstein and Brindell explain, an illegal's identity as a Soviet intelligence official is a secret from everyone except his espionage contacts. This, as the authors underscored in their 2000 book, is a weighty factor in favor of the argument that Hopkins was a conscious Soviet agent. Hopkins had plenty of workaday contacts with open Soviet officials, and indeed, they make appearances in Sherwood's biography. Not Akhmerov. In dealing with Baltimore furrier Akhmerov, Hopkins, the president's right hand, was dealing with an undercover super spy master, someone who, according to Matrokin and Andrew, controlled most political intelligence operations in the United States. His premier stable of agents included Nathan Gregory Silvermaster, who ran the Silvermaster Network, Lawrence Duggan, Alger Hiss, Michael Greenberg, and more. Given the stakes, maintaining his cover was crucial, and so he did. It would take decades for American intelligence to identify the spymaster, whom they simply knew as Elizabeth Bentley's Bill. Akhmerov, Romerstein and Brindell write, had no reason to break cover as a middle-class businessman and reveal himself as an intelligence officer of the Kremlin to Hopkins, unless Hopkins were an agent himself. Here we see the stunning significance of Gordievsky's claim take shape. So then what happened? Not much, really. The revelation that pulled the pin on the biggest grenade in American history turned out to do little lasting damage. FDR's right hand and alter ego, the co-president and Svengali, who was always there for lunch with Churchill, dinner with Stalin, breakfast, lunch, poker, gin rummy, and fishing with Roosevelt, was said, on credible authority, to have been a Kremlin agent, the supreme Kremlin agent in the United States during World War II, and no one cared. Of course, it was almost as if Gordievsky and Andrew didn't want a large explosion themselves. Gordievsky, they write, gradually came to the conclusion that, despite his clandestine meetings with a Soviet illegal, Hopkins had never been a conscious agent. Really? How did Gordievsky gradually arrive there? Had he gradually gathered additional evidence? No, not any that he and his co-author develop in the book, gradually or otherwise. Rather, as Andrew and Gordievsky somewhat abruptly write, that interpretation, Hopkins as unconscious agent or useful fool, best fits the evidence on his career available in the West. What evidence is that? The evidence that Hopkins lobbied for the deserter Kravchenko's return to certain death? The evidence that Hopkins pulled strings to send uranium and nuclear know-how to the Kremlin? Or could it be, for the intelligence historians, that that pesky existing view of the world was blocking their line of sight again? Amazingly, with few exceptions, Romerstein and Brindell, for instance, Hopkins got a pass. Andrew and Gordievsky write, the probability is Hopkins was never a conscious agent. Probability based on what preponderance of fact? None is offered. The sentence should more accurately read, we surely hope Hopkins was never a conscious agent because that would change everything. Instead, they write, Hopkins did not depart from what he saw as American interests. Hopkins acted from determination to prevent a Nazi victory rather than from a secret commitment to the communist cause. Again, more declarations of wishful thinking. If anything, Andrew's defense of Hopkins has intensified even as the evidence, which he, to his craft and credit, has continued to present in subsequent works, has mounted. Noting KGB boasts that Hopkins had been a Soviet agent, Andrew with Matrokin writes in 1999, these boasts were far from the truth. Hopkins was an American patriot with little sympathy for the Soviet system. Far from the truth? Hopkins, the American patriot? No sympathy for the Soviet system? There is simply no evidence of Hopkins' patriotism other than the fact that he worked in the White House. There is only an assumption here, a faith based in wishful thinking, which is hardly the tool of good spycraft. In 1998, the late U.S. Air Force historian Edward Mark published a breakthrough in the Hopkins analysis, a meticulous examination of what appears to be the first damning document to emerge from the Venona record against Hopkins, specifically a partly decrypted Venona cable believed to have been authored by our friend Akhmerov, in which a very senior Roosevelt administration official, codenamed Source 19, conveys the contents of a private, top-secret conversation between FDR and Churchill in late May 1943 about the invasion of Normandy, which at that time was still a year off. By process of painstaking elimination, Mark determines that it is probable, virtually to the point of certainty, that Source 19 is Harry Hopkins. I read it and recommend that others do the same, and I buy Mark's meticulously marshaled logic. Far more important, of course, experts Romerstein and Brindell buy it too, and both Christopher Andrew and Vasily Mitrokin buy it, at least in endnotes, calling Mark's study detailed, meticulous, and persuasive. Haynes and Clare, however, remain agnostic, which has the unfortunate effect of eliminating the story, even the suggestion of the story, from their influential works. For example, their 650-page compendium Spies doesn't even footnote it. True, Vasiliev found little about Hopkins in the finite number of KGB files he was allowed to view and copy, although given the controversy, even that might merit a footnote. Leaving all Hopkins' analysis out of the research has the unfortunate effect of both suspending what should be an ongoing investigation and retarding curiosity. In his endnotes, peculiarly enough, endnotes are where much of the scholarly debate about Hopkins takes place, Edward Mark regards the state of the scholarship since Gordievsky first lobbed the Hopkins-Akhmerov revelation into the field nearly a decade earlier, which initially prompted vigorous debate in reviews of the book. Mark writes, "Since that time, however, scholars have published scores of books and articles on facets of American foreign policy related to Hopkins' activities. As far as I know, not one of these studies has dealt with Akhmerov's allegations." Mark, again, was writing in 1998. Today, more than 10 years later, 2 decades since the original claim, more than 60 years since Jordan offered his evidence, sworn testimony that Hopkins sent atomic plans to the Kremlin and pushed uranium shipments past the Manhattan Project embargo, we are still counting down to a real reckoning. Others have since pulled the same pin. Romerstein and Brindell, of course, in their 2000 analysis in the Venona Secrets. Investigative journalist Cliff Kincaid in his AIM report, Paul Kengor in his 2010 book Dupes. But to date, the implications of the evidence have yet to be grasped by the lapels and shaken. A Soviet spy and American traitor advised the president and himself made policy before and during World War II. This is a thesis that demands further confrontation, even if it might shift the balance of our historic understanding. Mark cites the indifference of American diplomatic historians to intelligence history, which is by now an old refrain in this book. He also notes their predominantly liberal political orientation. This, he writes, has led them to ignore the whole question of the relationship between security and foreign policy as smacking of McCarthyism. Ah, so, we're back to that old vampire, still sucking our past dry, destroying the vital flow of evidence that links facts to conclusions. Keeping the Hopkins story and the rest of our intelligence history in the dark, then, prevents the truth from coming in from the cold and keeps the national imagination from igniting, from throwing light into the black hole of anti-knowledge, from blowing up our totally phony consensus narrative. What follows is my own attempt. This will include my own dossier on Hopkins, the facts as I have found them, an admittedly fragmentary record culled from multiple sources, and my own try at assessing the implications and how they bear on something larger than any one man, something that seems to be missing, and inexplicably so, in the moral life and times of our society. This is our own hidden history, our stolen history, precisely the sequence of events we have lost virtually all trace of. Reclaiming it, then, becomes an archaeological exploration of the past, where our Kravchenkos, our Jordans, our Lyonses, our Joneses, our Dyeses, Conquests, and McCarthys lie buried, lost from our view of history. Little wonder we have lost our bearings, too.